to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Brandon Burton.
Hi, Mike.
Next to him, we've got Diego Stecco.
Hey, Mike.
Next to him, we have the one and only Bill Burgess.
What's up, Mikey?
And next to me, we have The Rock, the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike. Soon to be the Iron Man, too, I understand.
And today, joining us is a very, very special guest.
And who would that be?
Our special guest today is Larry Dropa, president and owner of API Audio.
Oh, yeah!
Come on!
Hello, good evening.
Here's some interesting Larry Dropa trivia. Number one, Larry Dropa was the first guest we ever had on the Audio Nowcast.
Wow.
Nice. 83 episodes ago.
Wow.
Boy, was I nervous.
What
cast?
What you were starting.
And Larry also, aside from API, he used to mix headphone monitors for Stevie Wonder.
True.
And
very
that's
nice.
Actually where I met him on tour. And me, Rob, and, well, that's about it in this group, have all toured with Larry.
We've been around the world together.
We certainly have, literally.
Wow. Literally, yeah.
And last but not least, the other thing is if you hang around with Larry on tour, you will always eat well.
We can attest to that. And you'll probably end up buying more photographic equipment than you had planned.
you may not like it, but you will eat it.
No, I knew me and Larry were going to hit it off when we were in Japan. And like Akihabara, he had the exact same appreciation for that place that I did. I'm like, I found
you
it.
You found a soulmate.
So, Larry, thank you for joining us again.
It's great to be here, Mike. Thanks.
It only took you, 83 episodes for you to make it.
I wanted to make sure it was going to catch up.
He is tough.
And Diego, thank you for joining us also.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
No, it was great. Diego, let's just start. He has a new YouTube out there, Music from a Bonsai.
Yes.
And last time we were here, it was Music from a Tree, and today it's Music from a Bonsai.
I'm just shrinking down.
But why don't you tell him a little bit of background on Music from a Bonsai, because you had to figure out how to do...
Well, basically, the Music from a Tree was the rehearsal for Music from a Bonsai. It's not a joke. I tried that before because I wasn't really sure how I could achieve it with the bonsai. Mm-hmm. But then I just tried, and I recorded all sorts of things, all sorts of noises, and I was able to put something together that resembles a composition. Obviously, you cannot expect any regular sound because it's a bonsai.
Right.
But
and so what would you search for on YouTube? What's the easiest way to find it?
You just type music from a bonsai.
Okay. Not a lot of competition for
that. No. Not at the moment. Right. You never know.
We'll put a link to it. But it's actually pretty cool. And you did that because you needed to do it. You needed to figure out a way to do it live for the Grammy Museum, right?
Yes. Basically, I presented it at the Grammy Museum the 1st of April, and we are going to do it again the 29th. It's a presentation for classes. I bring the bonsai, I bring microphones and the equipment and everything, and I invite one of the kids from the audience to play the elements, basically, and I show them how to use all the stuff. It's pretty interesting. They were speechless the first time they saw it.
Now, the big question is the bonsai going to make any new patches for any of the cool sound design
stuff?
You never know.
I'm not going to say anything in advance.
And did the bonsai agree to a buyout, or will there be royalties?
We're still negotiating the deal.
To work
but,
out.
Yeah.
And most important, there were no bonsais were hurt during the
Absolutely
filming.
Absolutely not. Matt, can you believe there's always people writing comments like, leave it alone.
Really?
Seriously?
Because they don't really understand how it works. They think I'm just shaking it to death. But if you put a contact microphone so close to it,
right,
you can just tap a little bit and it's going to sound huge. Microphones work that way.
Yeah.
But people think that I'm just hitting
it's
it.
It's like,
just
dude,
so
man,
loud.
I dig your music, man, but just be green, please. Whatever.
Well, tree abuse is a huge problem in the music industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
I guess I'm not really adding anything positive to this issue.
Right. Sheesh.
Well, it's pretty cool, and I saw the movie, and I just want to encourage everybody out there, if you want to check it out, go ahead and go to YouTube, and you can actually just put in Music from a Bonsai, or we'll put a link on our website, and so that you can just directly link to it.
Yeah.
But it's really neat. And the one thing I think people should pay attention is it's just a really creative way how, you know, you can make music with almost anything, you know,
yeah.
with rhythm and with tone that's out there. You could use a tree, a bonsai. I mean, do you have any other things you're going
to
try?
I do some other stuff in mind, but I want to try. But to me, the interesting thing is find sounds where normally you wouldn't think you could find them, you know, because it's pretty easy to do a composition with a bottle of, I don't know, iced tea.
Right.
Because there's a lot of sounds in it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take a bonsai, you have to think about it. You have to imagine how you would use it as a musical instrument. So you have to somehow decide what's going to be the kick drum, the bass, and everything. So
that's kind of cool.
The tricky part.
And is it kind of similar the way you do your sound design when you're designing patches? I mean, when you're doing this music thing, you get down to the individual elements and then you comp them together. I'm assuming that's kind of how you probably work when you do your sound design and
stuff
like that.
It's a little different because I think in a musical
I was wrong.
Way. No, but to give you an idea, I record all the elements as I would play a piano or a guitar.
Right.
It's a take that I record. And then when I go to the mixing part, I actually refine all the elements that I recorded in a way that make me happy. You know, I have to have the sound that is defined the way I want. So there is a sound design part involved, but it's mainly sound design applied to your musical performance.
I got you.
Musical, of course.
So are you mixing in Final Cut?
No, I'm mixing in Pro Tools HD, and I'm just doing the video in Final Cut.
But you cut picture first, right?
I do the things at the same time because I want to make sure that what I'm playing, actually it's clear on the video.
Yeah.
So what you see on the video has to be understood because it's not a video clip. It's not supposed to, you know, emphasize how cool it is to play with the bonsai. It's to show actually how I am extracting the sound from the bonsai in that particular moment from the cortex or the twigs, the leaves and stuff.
So you have to keep track as you're editing the audio. You have to keep track of what take everything is so that you can assemble the video to match it.
It's pretty easy because I do, let's say I do 5 takes. I just do them in the same timeline. I don't stop and I film everything. So basically I can just find again the spot later. It would be easier to do with time code, but I don't have the time code on the thing that I'm using I'm using Pro Tools LE to record it, and then I move it to HD to mix it.
Gotcha.
But it's not really a big deal.
I think actually that editing video in Pro Tools is amazing. Have you tried it?
No, not yet.
It's crazy. No, it's great because you can edit. Sample accurate.
Yeah.
So you edit, and then the video will just round out to the nearest 30 frames or whatever, 24.
But
it's a great, great, great way. I haven't opened up Final Cut in about 9 months.
If you're just doing
cuts.
But
I do a lot of video edits. Yeah.
But you know what helps me?
If you're just
me,
doing cuts, though.
Yeah, it's got to be straight cuts. It helps me to do color correction because I get inspired for the sound by the color. I need to color correct the video so I can get an idea. It's all part of the same thing. It's like pasta, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm cooking and it doesn't look great, it's not going to taste good. And the video and music to me is the same thing.
And you know pasta.
I know something about it, yeah.
Well, that's great. You know, I just want to encourage people to check it out on YouTube, and we'll have a link to it. I want to move on to something really quick because I think we need to talk about it. We mentioned it a little bit last time, but I picked up an iPad.
And, yes, you did.
Isn't that thing you have right there?
And I must say that, you know, I was a little skeptical at first.
No, you weren't.
Yeah. Yes, that, how long did that last? 10 minutes?
No, listen.
3 minutes of skepticism.
I knew it was going to be rad. I just didn't know it was going to be super awesomely rad. Okay? So there's where the skepticism came in.
Right.
But really, guys, it's one of those things where, you know, the future just doesn't start. It kind of just morphs into our daily lives. And it's one of these appliances that is just, we're going to look back and we're going to say it started here and everybody's going to have a pad type of device. That's going to be the new computing platform because it's so convenient and it just makes a lot of sense. For instance, not only just, you know, you hear about the books and you hear about the magazines and things like that, but just, some of the developers out there, what they're doing with the music application is really phenomenal. I've got a couple where they're virtual controllers, so you can step away from your fixed position, and you can control your Pro Tools or your Logic system or whatever you're working on. And, you know, that's going to change the way we do a lot of mixing. That's going to change the way we do a lot of things. For instance, I know when I'm mixing 5.1, sometimes in my room where I mix, you know, I'm in the sweet spot, but how many times are people going to actually be sitting in the sweet spot in their living room when they're listening to this stuff? You know, never. Because most home studios, most home systems are set up, you know, mediocre at best, unless you're Larry. but what this will allow me to do is it'll allow me to get up and I can sit in the back of the room and I'll be able to make little tweaks just because, you know, if you hear something in a different environment, it could really help you be creative. And sometimes, like, a lot of surround mixing, for instance, a lot of times you mix surrounds for that sweet spot. But since nobody is sitting in that sweet spot, get up, go to the back, and if something's kind of, you know, being a little distractive because you know it's going to be heavy surround and a lot, like a lot of home studios are, then you can go back there, hear it from their perspective, and make the tweaks that you wouldn't normally make if you were down below.
Makes sense.
You
know? That holds true for stereo as well, actually.
Yeah, so it's a... It's an awesome replacement for an extension cord. No, you
can do more than just faders. You can actually, you know, tweak parameters on, you know, your reverb or your EQ or things like that. It's coming. You're going to see it. Rob, even you will have one day.
Oh,
it's
going to
be
one,
a great, yeah, XY controller is what I see it as.
I could see it as that. I mean, I'm definitely going to have one. I personally think that, same thing on the iPhone. There are zillions of apps whose sole purpose is to show what a cool app it is, you know, and all the little synthesizers and sequences and all these other things. They're really cool, and it's impressive that someone could get a phone to do that. But compared to actually using something that's not, you know, 2 by 3 inches or whatever, it's not very good. So a lot of these applications have a lot of ooh-ah factor, but when you actually sit down and use them, I mean, like, I'd rather have – what is the iPad like? 8 by 10 inches or something?
Yeah.
Roughly. I mean, I'd rather have an actual, if I was going to be controlling Pro Tools or something and moving around the room, I'd actually rather have a controller with buttons, and I wouldn't mind if it had an extension cord. You know, wireless isn't as big a deal as a good ergonomic surface. I'm not saying the apps aren't cool, and they look incredible.
Right.
But the jury is still out. I agree that I think the iPad is a game changer, and I think everybody's going to have one on their coffee table, and I think it's going to be the thing you reach for instead of a magazine. You know, if you're watching TV and you want to Google something or you want to read something, it's incredibly cool and convenient. It's the exact right size. So I think it is an incredible thing. But I think a lot of the apps in the beginning are just sort of ooh-ah, and a lot of them aren't going to actually be that useful.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's definitely the ooh-ah factor, but some of them are actually pretty darn useful. The controller stuff, the open source controls and all that. That's pretty useful.
Yeah, but you got to get it. You got to get it working because there's no actual.
It's simple.
Easy interaction.
It's really easy though. All you need to do is on the same network, the same Wi-Fi network, and the computer, your host computer, doesn't have to be Wi-Fi. It can be, you know, on an Ethernet. As long as you're in the same network, basically you run a mini server on it, and the application will search it out and open up all the lines of communication once it finds it.
And half the audience says, yeah, that sounds easy, and half the audience says, I have no idea what you're talking about.
You know. Well, that's
there's only one thing that
sounds a little bit problematic, actually.
I
can see Ableton doing that, but I can see you grinding forever with Pro Tools and possibly Logic.
Yeah, Ableton for sure, definitely the live performance application.
But when you have big really buttons cool. to move, big faders to move, it works. But when it comes to typing?
Yeah, but I'm not saying this is going to replace anything. This is not going to take control of, you know, your big system and you can get rid of your D command. I'm just saying this is just going to be a really useful toolbox that you can do these things with really, really easy. I'll give you a good example. This past week, I was working with Nickelodeon and we were doing this TV show, and they brought in one of the actresses for Nickelodeon, cause we had to do some ADR, and she had to sing a line, and the music director was there and said, oh, do you guys have a piano? And so I didn't have a piano, but I had a little controller, so I had to open up my, my laptop. I had to go the whole thing just so that you can, you know, play a chord so that she could hear a chord. Well, they have a piano app that sounds like a piano. Had I had my iPad there, I would have said, yeah, here, look, boom, would have plugged into the system and you could have hit a chord. So the little things like that will help define how useful this is.
I agree with
little
you.
Little things like having a FireWire port and a USB port would have been nice.
Yes, I agree, but you know,
those guys, every time they, I think it's a part of their business plan is to drop a port for every release. Yeah. Think just, about it.
But they're running out of ports to drop.
But you know what?
Next thing is going to be the screen. You know, it's just
With Wi-Fi, like I said, it's not going to take over right now, but we're on our way, and we're going to be heading that direction, and you're going to see it. I guarantee you, in 2 years, all you guys will have one, and you'll all have
everybody
great
will
uses.
Play pianos. I always carry a piano in my pocket anyway.
And a bonsai tree in the other.
Why not? I mean,
so I have a question that's tangential and totally completely self-serving, but these new laptops, the MacBook Pros that just came out, 8 gigs of RAM, 500 gig drives. FireWire 800 was reintroduced. Does anybody here think that you could run an LE system with a FireWire 8 to 4 cable?
Sure.
You think?
Absolutely.
Because that would be swing.
No, you can do that. I've done that, actually.
Have you? Okay, yeah. So that's the answer.
For,
cause
that, the
was audio, self-serving, that was self-serving, but that's... It keeps me from having to Google on my iPad.
Yeah.
No, it actually
so it'll work.
Really,
oh. There's no. It's just a speed thing.
And it's just an adapter cable. Actually, on a FireWire 800 connector, we're getting really geeky for a moment.
Aren't you glad to see 800 reintroduced? There was a period of time on the laptops where it was gone.
Yeah, that is a cool thing, and we ended up having to buy a bunch of. Slot stuff. What is it? PC Express or whatever they call it.
Yeah, but
the card slots.
It's always been on the.
It always
MacBook,
had the 800
MacBook
on the big
Pro.
MacBook Pros.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I
guess that shows how long it's been since I looked at it.
But on the connector, the way I understand it is, on the 800 connector, you have 400 and 800. So it's not actually doing a conversion from 8 to 4 when you hook up the adapter cable. There is actually FireWire 400 on that same port.
It's just picking up the 400.
Right, it's just picking up the 400 part. That's why the cables aren't like hugely expensive.
But
They're
the question is, why
anything.
The connector sucks so much? It gets out of the.
You know what?
All
I wish
time.
I knew that too. We have had to trash so many laptops
for live performance,
over the years.
It sucks. Like this thing will fall out. Like where you're.
We've had to trash laptops because the port went, and it's so expensive. You know, if that port goes, you replace everything but the power cable.
Right,
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
I've had to tape those things in for live gigs, just like masking tape.
It's the opposite of a military. Connector. It's just totally flimsy.
You know what? If you guys are using your laptops with a FireWire connection live, invest in some Velcro and stick a portable laptop to
or
the back.
Or maybe we can just use
this
the
is
iPad.
3 years ago, Mike.
Well, they have Velcro back then.
But how can we purchase Velcro if Apple doesn't make it?
Right. Well, is there a Velcro iPad application? That's what I want to know.
I mean, I distrust FireWire in performance so much that I always have the 8mm or the tiny mini jack plugged into an XLR. And I have that as a backup because I know that those FireWire drivers are going to dump.
You know what? Never had a problem with FireWire drivers.
Because you have an iPad. That's why.
No. Even when I was teching and building big MIDI rigs and sample libraries and everything, never had a problem with FireWire.
No, we haven't either. If we knew going into building the setup that we had to make sure there was never any tension on the port,
right.
And everything was all tied up inside a box, we never had any problem either. And there's different qualities of FireWire cable. If you buy a FireWire cable and plug it in and you don't get that good ka-chunk.
Yeah.
Never heard that. I didn't even know it was actually making it.
There's got to be a ka-chunk because you got the wrong stuff, dude.
There is a little ka-chunk on
you
a
cable.
You're
also getting a new reality for me, right?
That's true. Try it out.
Wow. So, okay. Well, Larry, when are we going to have a FireWire report on a 512?
Boy, I don't know.
Hopefully
it'll be a while.
Make sure it does the ka-chunk.
We're working on
it. Oh, API stuff does the ka-chunk. You don't have to worry.
I like that.
API is ka-chunk.
I like that.
Actually, and with that, let's we're going to segue into talking with Larry and API. So, Larry, welcome. And, since you were here last time, API has done all kinds of really cool stuff, from everything from the A to D to now the new 500 series compressor to actually JDK Audio.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, let's just start really quick. Why don't we talk about JDK, because that's a great line, especially for a lot of our listeners. Tell us a little bit about the story behind the whole JDK Audio line.
Well, it's a product line that we developed because engineering every now and then would say, well, why can't we build another cool sweep EQ, or I couldn't make some other kind of mic pre. And the requirement is always that it has to be, if it's an API piece of equipment, it has to have the op amp and the transformer. So we developed JDK as a separate product line of high quality pieces of gear, but not necessarily having to be constricted by the design parameters of API. So some of the stuff is solid state and not necessarily all discrete and not necessarily transformer, but good high quality pieces.
And because you're not, you know, constrained by the, by having to use all the classic API pieces, it just so happens that manufacturing tends not to be as expensive, and some of this stuff is, because it's not really a budget line.
It wasn't designed to be a budget line at all. But it turns out that I think due to some of our experience in manufacturing, you know, some of that product line tends to cost a little bit less than the regular API stuff. But still, the design criteria is high quality.
Yeah, because the EQ, for instance, definitely has an API heritage, right?
It does, yeah. The four-band sweep EQ is from a company called APSI, which was kind of a spinoff with a few engineers from API that developed a line of consoles and EQs that were sold in the API catalog, in fact, because they at that point they had a fairly good relationship, I guess. And so the APSI products were sold in the API full line catalog.
EPSI.
Yeah. So creating some more confusion.
Confusing.
Yeah, yeah. But the consoles didn't go very far successfully, but people liked that four-band sweep EQ. So there are a number of engineers who think that's a great piece of gear, and there's been some refurbished and all, but we decided, well, let's bring it back as a product and a separate piece of gear. So we did, and API doesn't make a sweep EQ at all, so it doesn't conflict with anything else that we make.
And I know Richard Dodd and Vance Powell, you know, the guys out in Nashville, they really like those EQs.
Yeah, that APSI EQ has been a favorite of Richard Dodd's for a long time.
Richard Dodd, producer, mixer, Dixie Chicks, and Tom Petty, and a bunch of other people. Well, let's talk a little bit about, not only the JDK, let's talk about some of the newer pieces of API gear. For instance, a piece of gear that I know Brandon has, which is the ATD. Tell us a little bit about that and the theory behind that, and why you guys came out with that digital piece of gear, which is actually the best. It's my favorite piece of gear. It's the biggest bang for your buck, but I'll tell you about that later.
Yeah. Well, it's the only piece of digital gear that we manufacture. We decided to dip our toe in the digital waters and see what came out. And it's a two-channel, two mic pres based on the 212, 312 mic pre design, and then goes into an A to D converter that does all the standard conversions. It has the sort of advantage that you can loop in and out of the mic pre into the A to D, so you can add something else in that loop if you want to.
Does it have word clock?
It does have word clock now. The early units, it uses what we called a super clock that quickly became confusing with someone else's trademark. Yes. Super clock,
as which they don't use anymore.
Yeah. And it wasn't the same thing. It's just a high bit rate.
So a person could use your clock to reclock an M-box or something like that.
It doesn't work as a master clock.
Okay.
The clock in the A2D will clock to other devices, but not externally.
But you can clock an M-box to it through clocking off the SPDIF into an M-box, and that's actually a fantastic way to make your M-box sound better. Use the A2D as your front end, SPDIF into it, and you'll get better recording. It'll just sound better.
Or you just buy an API.
But it's actually the cool thing about the reason why I say it's my favorite piece of gear, because if you have a laptop studio and you're working off Ableton, or you're working off Logic, and you need a great front end. It's a great way to get into your laptop with high quality, high end mic pre's. But not only that, but then when you're done with it, come out of the output, go back into it, and get a little bit of analog summing, get a little bit of that little warmth happening.
Yeah,
it'll really
idea, yeah.
round out your mix. And then you come back into your Ambox, back into the Spitiff. And so you have this nice little loop. And at that point, you can also, since you can loop out of the mic pre's, you can put in line, you know, a stereo bus compressor. You can put in line, you know, a lot of really great, you know, if you have a 500 series rack or a lunchbox, mm-hmm. you can put those all in line, you know, and on your mastering side. So now you can do like your own little mastering with analog gear and have a way to come back into your Ambox. It's really handy. And, do you like yours, Brandon?
I love it. It's got really low noise, when you're recording something. Which works especially well if you live in Burbank and there's airplanes flying all the time. Also, I love that it has separate controls on the gain of the tube as well as the digital side. So if you want to crank the tube side a little more.
Analog side.
Analog side. if you want to crank that a little more, yeah. you can bring that up. Or if you want to, you know, make it a really, really clean, you know, recording, you can just turn up the digital side.
Yeah, you can really hit the mic pretty hard if you want to.
Yeah.
And dial it down as you go into the digital
and
side.
And even if you go, you know, you're going into the reds on there, it still sounds great.
Well, then you're getting the sound a lot of people think of as the API sound.
Yeah, that's the thing about the mic pre's is that, you know, a lot of people like to hit the red because they like to get that.
Well, on a great
center.
Mic pre, that's actually a good sound. On a crappy mic pre, that's a horrible sound. That's one of the things API mic pre's have been known for a really long time, though.
So, for the people that might not know, how would you describe it? Does it grab the sound when it hits red? Does it brick it? Does it describe it for people?
Well, it's because it's transformer designed. As you hit a transformer harder, it tends to go into what's called saturation, and the sound gets bigger, fatter, without getting audibly distorted. So it maintains a pretty big, fat sound even when you drive it hard.
It's like if you. It's compression-esque.
Well, you're rectifying the signal in an analog way, though.
But it doesn't break up. It doesn't get, like if you hit your L1 too hard and it just goes, you know, to hell in a handbasket, it's the total opposite.
But I'll tell you, like, if you want to hear one of the greatest sounds on earth, you get Nate Watts, who's Stevie's bass player, get him to play bass through an API mic pre.
Oh, man.
And hit it really hard. And hear what it does to the sound. Because that was an awesome sound 30 years ago.
Can I assume you did that?
I did that recently and a long time ago. We've been doing it for a long time. But that was a classic sound 30 years ago, and it's still pretty much
that's
hard
still
to
the
beat.
Benefit of using great analog gears
yeah,
versus digital.
It's nothing like
you can really push it, and it sounds great.
But we did happen to do that very recently, and it reminded me what an incredible sound it is, and there is no plugin on earth that can pretend to do that.
Now, is that the growl bass like on the beginning of I Wish, you know, that you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, I mean, he goes up and does the
yeah, exactly.
Stuff,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's Rob, really cool.
He's a big part of the equation, Nate.
Self-serving question for me, but when you're pushing into the red, how far are you pushing it? Just at certain peaks, or is it riding pretty close to that the whole
you know
time?
What? I don't usually look at it.
Okay.
A lot of people don't look at the meters on it. Maybe
set it here. Forget it.
Because, well, also, I'm doing it with a lunchbox. I don't have the A to D, I have a lunchbox with a bunch of mic pre's. And generally, I'll set them. I'll look over. If he starts to play and I just see some lights blinking and it sounds awesome, then we're good. I don't really. Well, there's some gear you can't do that. There's plenty of gear that if it's in the red, you're going to hear something you don't like later on. You may not notice it while you're tracking if you have a whole band there, but you go and listen to the tracks later and you realize, ooh, there's a few spots where that's just distorted. The API stuff, I mean, you got to make sure you're not overdriving your A to D. Because once you're past zero, it's like zero means zero.
Right,
you know?
Right.
There's nothing above zero. But as long as you're making sure you're not hitting the A to D so hard that it's clipping, you can basically pound the hell out of the API mic pre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you hit it hard enough, you will hear the saturation and you will hear the clipping. And you have to make a creative choice. But we don't usually make that choice based on any LEDs. It's really just how it sounds. On an A to D, you do have to watch the LEDs because clipping is unpleasant.
Now, is it mainly watching the D going out to your computer that you got to keep down? Can you crank the A side pretty hard?
You sure can, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you need to watch your digital.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Zero.
Definitely watch the digital. But
and not go over that.
If you crank that A side.
No, have fun with it. It just gets better and better sounding. Okay. Right up until the point where it sounds horrible, and then you just back it up a little bit.
You know, there are people who comment every now and then that the output of API gear is very hot, because they're feeding these days a lot of digital equipment. Mm-hmm. So some people do put a pad after the mic pre or after an EQ in order to hit their next piece of gear. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, this stuff was designed almost 40 years ago when you fed a digital analog tape machine that added more level saturation if you wanted it also. So it doesn't make sense from a company standpoint to redesign the gear and lower the output.
No, please don't do that. Yeah. Yeah. We have the opposite problem.
Yeah. Yeah. We crank down the one of my favorite changes to go through the API lunchbox with the mic pre's and some compression and EQ and then go into some Prism converters. To like get into Pro Tools as pristinely as we can at my place anyway. There are even more pristine things, but that's the best I got. And then we'll crank down the inputs to the Prism converter so that we never have to worry about hitting them too hard. Mm-hmm. Because realistically, our signals are all strong enough that the difference of, you know, if we pull it down 4 dB or 6 dB even, the end result sounds fine. I'd much rather be not quite using all of my digital headroom, but knowing I'm never going to clip the digital.
Right.
Because those digital clips, they really do come back to bite you. And especially if your stuff's going to end up being into MP3s eventually, which everything is, that stuff gets magnified. Those digital clips really do come back to haunt you later.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, I know it flew by, didn't it?
Wow.
It did. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about the lunchbox, we're going to talk about compressors, and we're going to talk about big analog consoles and small analog consoles like the 1608. So we will see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking with Larry Dropa, president and owner of API. And we were talking about the A2D and what a fantastic piece of gear that is. And now we're going to switch it over to let's talk a little bit about the lunchbox. Because when people think API, you cannot think of API without thinking of the lunchbox. And Larry, tell us a little history of the lunchbox itself, the actual form factor of that whole 500 series.
Well, truth be told, it's a version of the AFEX powered rack that they invented, if you will. But we converted modules that had gone into a larger console into what's now known as the 500 series that fit into a lunchbox, and have had a number of modules that fit into that form factor up until recently when we allowed other manufacturers to make pieces to go into that 500 series, and it just exploded the format.
Well, I will say that, first of all, on behalf of all, you know, analog audio guys, that was a very generous thing for you to do. It was basically take, you know, your format and release it open source.
Well, I think it was going to happen anyway due to the ease at which you can make a piece like that to fit into a powered rack. But we decided if people were going to do it, we would at least make the rules fairly open to everyone,
right,
so that everyone had the proper design criteria in order to make it. You know,
and you get to sell a whole bunch of empty racks to plug in.
Well, that was the hope, of course.
That's a very nice byproduct.
but you know what? But in a lot of ways, it's actually it, it started the analog plugin, because the 500 series modules are now, you know, there's a ton of them, and they're the analog plugins, you know, and I think that was just a great thing that analog kind of needed to happen. Somebody needed to say, hey, you know, this will be the standard, and everybody starts jumping on it. Now, that said, I do know that, you know, some people take liberties with the, you know, lunchbox spec, you know, with drawing more power and things of that nature.
Well, there's a forum now called the VPR Alliance that we ask people if you're going to make a piece of gear that you submit that piece of equipment to us so we can verify that it fits in the rack, it draws the required amount of current, and no more. And then, you know, there's no cost to anybody, a manufacturer, but then you're in the VPR Alliance, we call it, so that customers have the assurance that all that gear plays well together. Not everyone has signed on.
Has done
will.
That.
It makes sense for you guys. I mean, if you happen to buy one of those things that don't work, then are you blaming the module? Are you blaming the lunchbox?
Well, you know, you cannot
blame the lunchbox.
Well, they can blame the module because
exactly.
The rules have been laid out pretty clearly.
Exactly. That's
which
the
is
point.
Good.
So if somebody draws too much power, how does it affect the other?
Well, it has the potential of either hurting that piece of gear, or if one module draws more current than the allotted current per slot, for example, your next mic pre might not work as well.
It's suffering from the loss of.
Right. So it makes goes downstream.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is having that VPR Alliance allows you, Larry, as a manufacturer, when you manufacture like the 1608, where you can put in, you know, 500 series modules, if somebody puts in one that's not in the VPR Alliance and they have problems with their 1608, it's really easy to say, well,
I told you.
Well, exactly. We know where their problem is.
Right. And we do it as a protection. For the customer, mostly, because if you install a 500 piece into your, let's say, a console or even a lunchbox, and it damages that piece of equipment, we have a fairly strong warranty, which is 5 years. We warranty all of our products. And so if something fails in that warranty period due to a piece of gear that's not our own fault, then it's a little hard to support the warranty because someone else or some other piece of equipment caused a malfunction. So we don't look so lightly on those.
Well, it makes sense, though. And there are some – we don't have to name names now, but there are definitely some 500 series modules out there if you go online that are just – they're power hogs. And they will say, okay, if you're going to have a lunchbox – only use this module, nothing else, you know, or keep the next slot free. I mean, it's not uncommon to see that, for some of these modules out there. So the lunchbox, it's kind of taken hold, and like you were saying before, has it really blown up bigger than you ever thought?
Oh, absolutely has.
The 500 modules?
Yeah. Yeah. Now we were, of course, apprehensive about it, because if you allow other people to make stuff like your stuff, it has the potential to cut into your sales. But I think the strength of the brand, I mean, people, if you want API, you're going to buy API.
Right.
And so it's been good for everyone, I think, because it has allowed some smaller manufacturers, so some pretty cool stuff, to manufacture pieces that fit in that 500 format. And it's pretty cool pieces of gear.
And they save a lot on their development costs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then I think it's worked well for everyone.
Yeah. You go to the NAMM show or you go to AES, and now you practically see a whole aisle of nothing but 500 series modules.
And to be quite honest with you, if there are going to be other manufacturers that make stuff in some form factor, we just soon have it be the API form after all.
Yeah. Well, it's a great thing. And on the backside of that too, if you're going to get a lunchbox and you're going to buy 500 series modules, you know, it's not like API makes, you know, bad 500 series modules. You're probably going to pick up a module or two of the, you know, the father of that whole thing, you know,
well,
the
we
API.
Hope so.
And speaking of modules, You guys just came out with an amazing compressor, the 527. We got to talk about that because the compressor has the magic button called the thrust button, which is absolutely the most phenomenal thing I've ever seen in a small compressor. Why don't you talk a little bit about the 527 compressor and how it differs from the 525?
Well, the 525 has been very successful for us, and a lot of people have used the 525 compressor for years and years and been in love with it. But in a console format, the consoles have a, what we call a 200 slot, and the 200 series modules fit into the most consoles. And so there's a 200 series compressor that has more parameter control than the 525. So due to a number of requests, we decided, well, let's engineer the 200 series compressor into the 500 series space. And while we're doing that, we added the patented thrust circuit that we have available into the 527.
Why don't you explain a little bit of what the thrust circuit is?
It's a very cool name, for starters.
Well, you know, it quite honestly tends to thrust the mix, or whatever you run through it, forward. Kind of puts it in your face. It enhances the low end, keeps the low end, and the high frequencies. Under high compression ratios, the thrust circuit maintains your high frequency content. So if you take a snare drum, for example, you hit a snare drum and then really compress it down, the first thing that tails off is the high frequencies.
Yep.
The snare drum will get dull pretty quickly. Whereas with the thrust circuit in place, you can dial in a lot of compression and your snare drum will still have a lot of high frequency content.
I can see, yeah.
Which I'm going to add to that, which allows you to sculpt your transients really on your
attack. I was already thinking to use that in a creative way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And really bring it to...
That's the thing, is you can, by messing with the ratio and, you know, you put the thrust in and you mess with the ratios, you can control that fast attack, that first hit transient, which really, I mean,
also in sound design, when you are, let's say, recording gunshots,
yeah,
the transient, it's so high that usually clips and people don't even pay attention to that. But in this case, you can somehow keep it under control and have the body of the, you know, the rest of the sound.
Yeah, that attack, mm-hmm. the really snap of the attack.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you know, in that case, it's super high.
Well, without asking for any secrets, can you explain a little what thrust is actually doing?
Well, it puts a filter circuit into the side chain that as you increase your compression, it essentially tips up on the side chain, tips up the high frequencies, so that as the audio is less affected on the high frequencies than the lows.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And it does it very effortlessly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just... It's the magic button.
Well, if it wasn't any good, it wouldn't be patented.
Right.
But you know what's amazing, though, and this is actually, I found this out through talking with Larry one time, the ATI Paragon, which was the company that got together. Well, it was the company before API, before you guys acquired API. Anyhow, on the Paragon, all the compressors have that. It's not a button. It's built into the compression. And that's why the Paragon board was used, you know, extensively on so many big tours, because people just the engineers just love that big live.
Well, they love the sound of the console,
yeah,
firstly,
yeah.
And the dynamics that were built on board they worked well, and they were, it was great dynamic control.
Because, like, every channel had full dynamics on every single channel.
A gate and a compressor, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Anyway.
I like that.
Really good sounding stuff.
No, you got to hear the 527, because it's just, it truly is, it's a phenomenal little compressor. And also the thrust technology is also on the 2500.
That's correct, the stereo bus compressor.
And you actually have more parameters for the thrust on the 2500. Do you want to explain what the differences are between those?
Well, the thrust circuitry is pretty much the same, but the 2500 is strictly a stereo bus compressor, works in stereo only, but has a lot more parameter control. So you can have the feed forward, the feedback. You have the ability to control the interaction between the left and right channels. So you can mix some control between the left and right, so that, let's say you had something panned hard to the right. That had a big transient. It doesn't bring the mix down in the right side and not the left, for example. So you can control how much of the interaction when you're using compression is kind of let through the door, if you will.
And for doing parallel compression for mastering of especially pop stuff, the 2500 is one of our secret weapons, because it's just, it gives such a presence to the mix. And if you use the thrust circuit, And we're usually doing it in parallel, so we're, you know, adjusting from cut to cut how much of it we're using, but it's just an incredible sound.
Now let's talk, you know, let me bring up a subject that might be a little touchy for you, Larry, but I think you guys really took a chance. but
we'll behave. We'll
promise. No, but the fact of the matter is, you know, API, for as analog as you are, you guys have a pretty successful, bundle of plugins with Waves and
correct.
How you know, talk to us about that little, you know, the internal conflict that went on to making that whole decision.
You know, that's another one of those things that we went around and around with for a long time when we were approached by not only Waves but some other people to let them create plugins. We were fearful that creating a plugin package would drastically reduce our hardware sales. And so it took some time to make that leap into the void, we called it at the time. but partnered with Waves, and I think they've done a really nice job of modeling the 500 series, the 550 A and B, the 560, and the 2500 stereo compressor. Are available in the Waves bundle, and they've done a really nice job with it.
Someone had done an unauthorized set of plugins.
A couple
right?
of people had, actually, yeah.
And so it was a really, I think, a brilliant thing to let – well, for one thing, Waves was set up to do it better than anybody else because they really figured out how to model these things well.
Well, what annoyed me at the time was that other people could make software versions of your hardware, and it's okay.
There's no recourse.
We retained some counsel to see if we could, you know, squash them a little bit. And the suggestion was made, you can either fight them or you can do it yourself and do it better. Mm-hmm. So we decided to go ahead and do it, or let Waves do it through us.
Now, I will say, as a user who's used both the hardware and the software, they do a great job, mm-hmm. but it's you're just not going to replace the analog sound. You're going to get pretty darn close, but there's nothing beats the real thing.
Well, there's not a software version of a transformer, as far as we know.
Yeah. Well, and also I found out that talking to a lot of people at the trade shows that I work at with you guys, it's a great stepping stone for some of these people to get into analog gear because mm-hmm. they use your plug-in and that makes them want to get a hardware piece. They
sure.
use the, you know, the 560, so that makes them want to get the hardware version of the 560. And I go on to tell them, well, you know, you buy a 560, you got a piece of gear that's going to last for 20, 25 years.
And also, it's a point of pride when you can show someone in your studio you have an API equipment. It always stands out somehow. It makes you feel, you know, more legit because you have, you know how to appreciate those things.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it's an investment. A, it's going to hold its value. B, you know, you don't have to pay next year for another $150 bucks to use your gear.
Yeah.
You know, and in the long run, it's probably going to be cheaper for you to buy the hardware version than for you to.
But I agree with you. It's a good way to get, you know, inside knowing API as a brand because a bunch of people don't know them because they grew up in the digital era. So they just know names that are written inside plugins.
Right.
So
it's a great way to get exposure to the
company. Yeah.
Well,
really
also.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm a Waves beta tester, and out of all the Mercury bundle, I've gravitated towards the API stuff, and I've never even seen the hardware. I mean, I have at trade shows and stuff, but...
Well, Bill, we should introduce you.
But I think it's kind of cool because there is a whole part of the market that don't have access to the old school audio dealer.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do blind listening tests or anything like that at Guitar Center. Like the old school Westwood Music or any of the old places where you could actually get in there and listen. You know, and it's a dying place.
You can download the demo of AP.
Yeah, but it's interesting to be able to work with the plugins on a day-to-day basis. And I find the hardware more tempting after that.
One of the things about when you're choosing these products for your studio, too, is, you know, with something like the 2500, if you're just getting a stereo Busmaster compressor, chances are if you're using it as that, you just need one of them. But for some of these EQs and compressors, you may want to have 20 of them or 30 of them. And that's where the plugins and the hardware are completely different animals.
Right, of course.
So there's no reason you wouldn't want to have hardware for some things and software for other things that would make sense, because most people are not going to buy a bank of, you know, 24 graphic EQs if they only need it for one project. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. And in that case, the difference between the hardware and the software is definitely superseded by the fact that you save thousands and thousands of dollars by using the software. So you do that. It's definitely cool to be able to get that real analog sound. Like Larry said, you can't totally emulate a transformer. And when you put them side by side, and I did a lot of listening, you know, in the early days of this stuff to compare them, they're very close. Waves did an awesome job.
Yeah,
but there
sure
still is a difference. You know, so if you just needed a stereo bus compressor and you only need one and you're going to use it on every project, well, guess what? You should check out the hardware.
But that's a popular choice. It. Even, you know, among people that can't really afford any expensive analog gear, they always try to keep the last step of the audio chain
for
to have something analog.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
It's a nice spot. To be, you know, to have
and
a product that sounds great. Mm-hmm. You know.
And actually the end, but also the front is a great spot too, because if you get a 512 and you bring it in as this pristine sound,
right.
you have a lot to work with, even if you can't at the back end.
But you know what? If you have a very limited budget and you can only get one piece of actual API analog hardware, it should be the mic pre. It should be the input stage. Yeah, the A to D is a perfect fit. You can do both with it, and, you know, your signal is only as good as its weakest link, and you don't want that weak link to be the very first step when you're bringing it into your computer.
Yeah.
You got to get it in there clean. It's much better to use a software version of an EQ rather than the hardware if using the hardware means you can't also have a good input stage.
I was more thinking about those people that don't really record themselves. Let's say people that do dance music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, they don't really record. They do a lot of stuff with synths. But if they keep the analog stage at the end, they gain a lot of quality.
Absolutely.
And in dance, you always overdrive the console.
Yeah. Always.
Because you want to have the fat sound.
Just make sure that if you are going to have that analog stage, which is an amazing stage to have, make sure that you have good enough quality getting in and out of your workstation. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing worse than doing an amazing – you could do a 96K 24-bit mix inside the computer and then come out through some horrible D to A's. And, you know, the whole thing just falls apart. You have to always think about in any production what's the weak link, because all of your hard work can be ruined by that one bottleneck.
Sure.
Now let's move on because API makes a ton of great gear. But let's talk about consoles. They're one of the last ones that still make consoles. I mean, Larry, how do you guys feel about that? I mean, when you see some of these other, you know, console manufacturers that just kind of, you know, wither away. I mean, are you guys, you know, you feeling lonely at the top?
We're sad, Mike. We feel sad. No, quite honestly, you know, competition is good.
Right.
To, you know, in black and white, if there's nobody else out there to compare yourself to, then you have a lot of work to do. And so it's been unfortunate that some of these people have gone by the way. However, a lot of analog companies have converted their product to digital. We're staunchly an analog company and probably always will be. We're kind of happy to be out there still making analog consoles.
Well, and you have – I mean, obviously, you have three different versions of consoles. You've got the Legacy, the Vision, and the 1608, which is – not only do you still make consoles, but you offer different kinds of consoles. Why don't we talk really quick about the difference between all three of those, you know, the – tell us a little bit about each one.
Okay, well, we'll start at the top with the Vision console, which is a 24-track stereo 5.1 capable, 5.1 and stereo simultaneously capable console. And then the Legacy series, either a 16-track channel strip with a stereo bus. And then the 1608, which is a 16-channel console with a stereo bus.
And recently you just...
Well, we had a milestone for the company. We introduced the 1608 just a little over 2 years ago, and just this week we popped in and celebrated with the customer who bought serial number 100 of the 1608.
100.
In these days, it's a lot.
Yeah,
these days.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And he was really cool.
Yeah, it was great.
Do we want to tell him who he is?
No, actually, a guy who works here in L.A. His name is Will Anderson. And he was just thrilled to be customer number 100.
And he got a free $2,500 out of the deal.
Wow.
And some swag. API t-shirt. A visit from us.
Yeah, congratulations.
That was very genuine. Well, I think the 1608 is, once again, that's just such a great product at the right time because it's a small form factor analog board, but it uses 500 series modules, and really any 500 series module that's in the VPR Alliance will work in the
1608. It's the only console that we make that will take 500 series modules. Yeah. And while we're talking about serial numbers, as we approached serial number 100 at the factory, we knew that we were coming up to serial number 100, and we made the conscious decision not to direct who got that console. It was just, whoever ordered, that's the guy that got it. And so it worked out that way. But then right after we packed up 1608, serial number 100, Richard Josephs, who was our production manager, came to me and said, we're getting very, very close to 512, serial number 10,000.
Wow.
And so, and strangely enough, this past week, we boxed up serial number 10,000.
Wow.
Of 512. Yeah.
Wow. Is there going to be a special presentation
on
that one?
There is. it's in the box, as they say.
Wow.
So lucky customer that opens that box will get a very nice surprise.
So wow. Larry is the Willy Wonka of audio.
Yes, he is. Right now, go to Vintage King Mercenary and start buying. Yeah.
So that 512 is not spoken for yet?
It hasn't left the factory yet, no. But it will be shortly.
Great.
Wow. So
do you have the FedEx tracking number? Just in case?
So tell everybody who your major dealers are.
Well, major dealers in the U.S. Are Vintage King, Mercenary, Sonic Circus, and those who I don't mention, of course, are going to feel terribly left out because there's 15 or 20 of them, Sweetwater.
Is a list on the website?
The list is on the website, yeah, which is probably more accurate than my mental capacity.
Well, other than Sweetwater, though, I think it's really kind of cool that you are with a dealer network, that you are with the little guys,
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think we've been very careful, and Sweetwater's a great dealer as well, and the sales team there are passionate about the products. But we've tried to be very careful to maintain a network of dealers for API that know what the product is, are passionate about audio and about the audio products, and really can represent the products well, because you don't want someone who's just pushing boxes out the door.
Yeah.
That's not what we've ever been about.
Yeah, because it maintains a certain integrity, and it maintains price protection on both sides, for the dealer as well as for the customer. You're not going to have to worry about, something.
Well, from an experience point of view, it's great that you go there and you know that you're going to get a great experience, a great presentation of the product. Because maybe you heard about API,
right,
and you expect something great, but you find someone that doesn't know how to use it, doesn't really know how to get that special sauce out of the gear.
And our dealers can help you do that. And I think one good thing about API dealers is they will generally allow you to try a piece of gear before you commit. Well, you commit to buy it, but they'll always take it back if you don't like it. They don't get too many back.
That's true. And that's why you have a 5-year warranty too, because it just doesn't break down. That stuff just works and works and works. Now, before we go, because we're running out of time, we have to answer the definitive answer to this question, Larry. What is the difference between the 212, the 312, and the 512? And besides the obvious features, mic circuitry wise, are they the same, or
it's the same circuitry in just a slightly different form factor.
Because you always see that on the boards.
Yes.
You always see people saying, no, the 212 sounds like this or the 312. And what I tell people is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of times, the electronics, if it's all analog, age bakes the capacitors. Age definitely plays a role into defining the sound of whatever piece of gear you're using. So maybe some of those subtle differences, and they are subtle, has to do with just the age of some of this stuff.
Well, that's entirely possible. However, from the lineage of the mic pres, the 312 was the first mic pre product, and it was designed on a little card that fit into a card frame. And so it's impractical these days to have that just open frame card as the mic pre.
Right.
So that kind of morphed into the 212.
It didn't have a panel when it was a card?
No, and it didn't have a front panel or a box around it even.
Wow.
It fit into an open frame in a console. It was generally in not even in the console, but under, you know, in the side
panel,
side rack of a console. So then that morphed into the 212, which then fit into the console. And then the Lunchbox series, the 212 expanded to be a 512.
That's amazing.
All the same.
So it's exactly. Just chassis differences.
Correct. Yeah.
I will say, one person we have to talk about, as long as we're talking about APIs, we got to talk a little bit about Saul Walker and just the fact that you basically reconnected with Saul after some years.
Walker founded the company, in 1969. And really is responsible for the core designs of the API products that we still manufacture today. And he, after, quite honestly, API drifted in and out of business a few times over its career. And Saul went on to other things. And then when we were able to acquire API in 10 years ago now.
Is it really that long?
Yeah.
Wow.
1999. And so we reconnected with Saul, and we've had him in our booth at several AES shows, and did a little ad that highlighted some of Saul's designs to give him the notoriety that I think he hasn't had,
right.
That he certainly is well deserved.
He absolutely, because his designs are just phenomenal. I mean, they're just, and he's the nicest guy. If you get a chance to go to AES or any of the trade shows where he may be at, especially if you're in the New York area, because he tends to go to those.
Correct.
He's a fantastic guy to talk to and just brilliant. And I had the opportunity to interview him for about 2 hours and he designed radar. I mean, he did some really high end stuff back in the day.
Yeah. He has a background in military equipment design, which is why the API stuff is very well built and lasts for so long is because the original designs were military spec.
Right.
And the original, what API stood for, had nothing to do with audio.
Had nothing to do with audio, no. The original automated processes name came from the design for, embarrassingly enough, a theater curtain control system for theaters.
Wow. See, that would have been a really good trivia question.
The sound that it was making when it was moving was amazing.
That's right. It was the best sounding curtain you've ever heard. we're going to have to wrap it up. But, Larry, where's API going? I mean, it seems like you're working on some cool stuff, and obviously you're not going to tell us all the secrets. But.
Well, Mike, we're going down that analog highway. we got some exciting stuff on the drawing board. But we're going to continue to do what we do and continue to have some fun with it.
Is the JDK stuff through the same dealers?
Not necessarily. There are some API dealers that are JDK dealers, and we have a network of other dealers for whom the JDK products are a little more appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, Larry, thank you so much
for
joining us. Larry Droba.
Thanks.
I love API as a company, not only because the people behind it are awesome, but it's great product. It's just really good product. And, you can recommend it to your friends and you will look like a genius.
Yeah. That's true. No one is ever going to give you grief for choosing API. That's true.
And an API, it has its sound, and you buy a piece of API gear for what it sounds like. And ultimately in audio, that's a good thing, you know?
Well, and if you want to hear an API console, just listen to most of your favorite albums.
I mean,
really quick, just a couple of the classics that have been cut on.
Classics, we can go way back, all the way back to early Led Zeppelin, the first three Lynyrd Skynyrd records, the early Aerosmith, early Steve Miller, and then you zoom right up till today. We go to the Killers, the Raconteurs, the Fray. In fact, maybe I can let it out. just this week, Dave Grohl bought a console.
Kings of Leon?
Kings of Leon. Right.
And don't forget Songs in the Key of Life. A lot of that was done on one.
The company has a fabulous history of what we call the American sound of rock and roll.
Absolutely. Well, it was like, you know, back in the day, we were trying to get the British sound, and over in England, they were trying to get the American sound.
Right.
It was pretty funny. Well, it was. I wasn't even there. I was like four.
But you've heard.
But I've heard.
Rob was in his early 40s back then.
You know what? I still had a good attitude back then. That's how long ago that was.
All right. Well, if you want to find out any more about API, you want to find out, you know, where you can get the stuff, where you can listen to stuff, you can go to the API website, which is apiaudio.com.
Correct.
And there's going to be some cool stuff that'll be happening to the website, you know. So just check it out, and you can find out about all the gear. The cool thing about the website is you can also download the manuals, and you can read. They've really written a lot of good stuff about each piece of gear, so you know exactly what it does. Well, gang, we're going to have to wrap it up. Rob, you working on anything right now that you can talk about? Anything fun and exciting?
Working on a few things. Actually, the CityLoveMusic.com website that I mentioned last time is up and running and going strong. And we've had thousands of people check it out. And as of this morning, we had 125 songs submitted.
We need to plug... really quick, you want to listen to an awesome song, you got to listen to Bobby's Sydney. That was...
On the City Love
on
site?
On the City Love site.
Yeah, it's a pretty good song.
It's a great song. Bobby Summerfield.
Hey, you trying to skew the vote?
No, because it's a demo.
You can't vote for that because it's one of the City Love collaboration songs. Yeah. So you can download it and actually write to his tracks, but you can't vote for it.
Yeah, that's the only reason why we're
going to. So it's
safe. But you can do mine. You can vote for mine at.
But so the City Love site is going well, and people have been voting and submitting. And we're still at the stage because the contest is so new. It's mostly people submitting songs they already had. So we're waiting for that moment when the songs that people are writing for the contest start showing up. But luckily for me, the website's been working great, and it's been a lot of fun to watch all the demographics because we've had people submitting from all over the planet.
What's the prize for this?
The prize is $10,000 and international distribution for your song and a lot of publicity.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool. CityLoveMusic.com.
CityLoveMusic.com.
And if you do run into any technical problems with the site, I really don't want to hear about it. I'm busy. I'm doing other stuff. But the other thing we're doing is a couple years ago, I wrote the music for the Heineken Museum in Amsterdam, which is a huge tourist attraction, and they take you through this sort of the process of bottling beer. And we did this really cool interactive music thing where you're in a theater that has motion control and all kinds of cool stuff. But it's been such a huge success that they want us to do another version of that. So in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be going back to doing beer music.
Cool.
Nice.
Which is really cool.
Beer. Do you have like rides and attractions there? Like, you know, journey through the keg or something?
That's kind of what this is.
You sit in a bottle and you just...
Yeah, that's right.
That's kind of what this is. The other thing is pretty soon, hopefully by the time you post this, if you want to check out all these things we're working on, there will finally be a noisyneighbors.com.
Nice.
For my company. So you'll be able to check that out.
Hand-coded by Rob himself.
That is true. In my spare time, which is like 3 seconds a week.
Bill, are you working on anything right now? Or?
Yeah.
I mean, you're always working on stuff. Is stuff you can talk about?
Yeah. Just started a pretty fun series of mixes with a producer out in Detroit, Elijah Lewis, old friend.
Great.
Met him at NAB. He gave me a Capybara 360, just gave it to me back in the day. Mm-hmm. But now we're working together on a very urban project. It's very Lady Gaga kind of
cool
sound. And I get to – it's not just mixing, but it's hefting up the grooves, which I do a lot of. And another – in that same line, I'm doing adding some – beef and heft to a series of aerobic videos of all things. But you know, these guys are great at writing melodic stuff. They write to picture, but they need some stank on their grooves.
Right.
And so that I get a lot of that type of work.
That's great. And you do a great job too, because I've heard your grooves, so I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
So it's been fun.
Diego, are you moving on to sunflowers now, or what?
I'm experimenting with invisible now. Yeah, I'm
basically working on a new project. I can't say anything right. about it, but I'm writing down a lot of things because it's going to be interesting, to say at least. I am mastering some tracks that Brandon will listen to soon. And then I'm expanding a little bit the concept of Music from a Bonsai for the next presentation that I'm going to do at the Grammy Museum the 29th. Because we've seen a lot of things that kids reacts better, so I want to introduce certain elements into the presentation. And that was really fun. So I'm looking forward to do it again.
That's only 9 days away.
Are you doing any more sound designing work or any are that?
I can't say anything.
You can't. Oh.
But I'm always doing something.
All right. We just won't say anything.
Cool.
that's great. Sometimes you learn a lot by not knowing anything.
Right.
Brandon, how about yourself?
We're kind of the same things as last week, yeah.
Is it still super secret, still top secret? Still?
Well, there's that one that's sort of in limbo right now.
At least I'm not the only one that can say anything. No. Yeah.
And I know that one, and we really can't say.
But the other one, still working on A-Team. I think I said that last podcast. Still,
well, that's cool.
That's been kind of fun, you know, it's a childhood memory. Doing that and working on recording some music of my own at home right now.
Oh, that's great.
Looking forward to cranking my A2D this weekend.
Saturated, baby.
Yes. Yeah. Saturate that.
Hitting it hard and heavy.
Yep.
Well, that's great.
Spank the meters.
How about you, Mike?
Let's see. Well, I just finished a hellacious week. And I actually, I told Larry, because we talked earlier in the week about, I just wanted to talk tonight about working with irrational people.
I know the clients, yes.
but I mixed a Nickelodeon show, so that'll be coming up, like in 2 weeks. So we're going to be doing a series of those. Other than that, just kind of working on a couple other small little things here or there. And,
Playing with your iPad.
I bet! Yes!
And playing with the iPad.
Showing everybody your iPad.
Mostly playing with the
iPad. You know what? You do not play with the iPad. You experience.
Oh.
Steve Jobs got to
us. Awesome.
And you know what? It's going to take over. This form factor will take over. Whether you like it or not, we will all be.
It's hard to say no to you at this point.
I actually happen to agree.
It will. It's going to. You know, everyone's going to have one on their, you know, in their house. I'll tell you what, last thing on the iPad, but, I have kids. I've got two little kids and it is absolutely fantastic to experience a computer with your kids. You know, you can go to their websites and you can be on the couch and they're sitting next to you and you're pointing things down or we're watching, you know, Wall-E on Netflix and stuff like that. It really takes computing to a social level that it just has never been at.
Yeah. And in the old days, you had to talk to them.
No, but that's
so bad attitude,
no,
Rob.
But you totally
check your attitude, pal.
You are interacting with your kids. It's like
now you send them an email to say go to bed.
No.
It is something to do together.
It really is. You're sitting there and you're talking. And you're like, hey, look at that, and it was really great. We were watching roller coaster videos and ride videos off of YouTube, and my son wanted to see this ride video, and then my daughter was like, let's watch this one, and you're like, you're experiencing all these things with your kids, and it's a social thing. It's not like, you know, you're not at this desktop or you're not behind
all crowded around one office chair.
Yeah, we started on the couch and then later on, we were upstairs and we're laying down and they're both on the pillow and we're looking up and we're holding this up. It's just a whole different lifestyle appliance.
That's the new iPad commercial.
the day that it came out, I thought to myself, there is the best music performance mouse ever made. Huh. Mm-hmm. That has got to be the most insane multi-touch gestural music controller that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then I went to the gym and I thought, every single aerobics machine ought to have a slot for the iPad.
Absolutely. I want to see editing Final Cut Pro with this thing, just, you know, chopping up video clips and moving around.
Well, it's already a mess to use it with a computer sometimes.
and then I actually looked at some of the specs and the lack of USB and the lack of certain other things, and I was like, ugh, darn it.
But, you know, just because you lack USB doesn't mean you lack communication. You just can't do it on the USB spec. That doesn't mean they couldn't develop, you know, other types of accessories that plug in through the you know the iPod,
like the camera.
There you go.
Well, which also is an interesting this thing called Square Up. You guys onto this? Square Up is a little device that plugs into your iPhone, and it's a credit card reader.
Right.
And so you can actually sit there
And wipe out your credit card.
Well, no, you can actually, you know, if you're doing, like I sell tons of gear on eBay, always have, because I've learned in audio, unlike Rob, that you have to keep it moving.
I keep it moving in one direction.
Yeah, I mean, I have my Emulator 2 Plus in the cellar, but the rest of it I try to keep moving. But you basically make a transaction. Somebody comes over to check out the gear, and they swipe the card on this Square Up.
That's awesome.
Which is pretty cool. So maybe there'll be something like that on the iPad. But
you know, I think that the key with the iPad is it was designed for a few very specific purposes, and a lot of the things we're talking about are things that it can do, but they're not what it was really for. Because let's face it, even the audio business is tiny compared to what it can be used for planet-wide.
Right.
And it's just going to become the next coffee table device.
It's a window that you can bring with you. That's
right.
Basically
and it's
it
a reader. And it's,
yeah,
that's
I'm going to sell this to Steve Jobs along with your speech.
<That's right. laughs> But it's, for what it was actually designed originally for, it's absolutely perfect. The connectivity is right. You know, it's meant to be a certain thing, and people are going to use it for lots of other things. But
did you guys hear about today? It's online. Apple has patented a concert ticket thing, something basically to replace the concert ticket with your iPhone. And it works in the way.
So now they're going to be going up against Live Nation too.
You know how like when you plug certain cars, it has a chip in the key. When you plug it in, it won't start without it. It's something similar to that. The thing, it won't come out at least till the next generation of iPhone, but where it, you know, you have this little thing and they just scan you as you walk by and you're good to go.
Well, that's like boarding passes for airplanes right now.
And and there's a lot that goes in with along with that as well. You can basically use that as your almost as your credit card. Then you can scan it and
then we can have it all embedded into our foreheads with numbers on it.
Yeah. Awesome.
And then it'll all end.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, listen, we have gone way too long, but see already the iPad. It's just spurred all this conversation. Well, if you have any comments, questions, or you just want to yell at me for being an Apple fanboy, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And if you want to reach API, once again, you can reach API at apiaudio.com. That's apiaudio.com. And that's about it. So you guys take care, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.